This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the...
The Headlines Iran says it will return to the full implementation of the JCPOA obligations if the U.S. and the E3 fully meet their commitments under the deal. The U.S. reportedly carried out airstrikes on Iraqi forces in Babo province, killing several people. And Tunisian police clash with the demonstrators as nationwide protests against police and the economic crisis enter their third night. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has called on all signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal to uphold their end of the bargain. In an interview, Majid Takht-Ravanchi pointed to U.S. obligations under the international accord and U.N. Resolution 2231, which endorsed this agreement. He said not only the U.S., but the European parties must also request their commitments under the deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. The Iranian diplomat said the administration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden must lift all sanctions mentioned in Resolution 2231, adding that Tehran will not accept Washington meet its obligation halfway.
Over the past few years, the U.S. has changed the name of some of the sanctions that were lifted under the JCPOA. For example, it has renamed the sanctions imposed on Iran's central bank. This is not our problem. It's up to the Americans to solve their problems. It's unacceptable for us to hear them say, we will comply with the JCPOA, but we won't lift these sanctions because they have been recategorized.
Dr. Ravanchi further said that Iran will go back to full compliance with its obligations under the deal once all parties do the same. The U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA back in 2018 and reimposed unilateral sanctions on Iran. Tehran, in return, announced that it will gradually scale back on its commitments, citing the remaining signatories' failure to meet their obligations. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says Tehran will go back to full compliance with its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal once all parties do the same. We discuss this in our news review. Let's take a listen. Now, to discuss that further, from Sydney, we are joined live by Mr. Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, and also Jason Unruhe, political commentator, who's joining us out of Ontario. Let's begin with Mr. Tim Anderson. Now, Mr. Anderson, do you see any preconditions the U.S. should be seeking if it would be to join the JCPOA once again?
Thank you. Yes, I think there's going to be a big struggle within the Biden administration or behind the Biden administration, because the point of this, of course, is not really about the nuclear industry. It's a pretext to try and contain the influence, the leverage that Iran has in the region. And in the last decade, with the wars that the U.S. has conducted, necessarily the coalition of groups has come together and Iran's role has become more important. So I think the political argument really within the U.S. after the 20th of January will be, you know, how are we going to get some more leverage in this situation? That will make it very difficult for Biden, even though he was in the administration that agreed to the JCPOA in the first place, to go back without trying to impose some sort of extra demands. And of course, Iran has no incentive really to comply with any additional demands. So Iran is in a strong diplomatic position, but I think there's a great risk that the Biden administration won't be able to find a way to go back to original agreement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Onrua. What about you? What do you think would happen? First of all, do you believe that Joe Biden would try to join the JCPOA once again, rolling back everything Trump did, which him himself was actually trying to roll back everything Obama did?
I certainly think that there's a good deal of a chance that Biden will return to the original JCPOA agreement. I mean, aside from the fact that it was an agreement that was running, that was functioning properly before the Trump administration fraudulently claimed that Iran was violating it, the Biden administration, you know, in his time with Obama, did spend a significant amount of time and energy creating that agreement. So I think that they're probably not willing to write up an entire whole new agreement when one already exists to begin with that both sides more or less still agree to. So I don't see as it being worth to create another one. And I think that Biden's foreign policy will be much more in line with Obama's foreign policy, so there will probably be a return to that. I wouldn't be too surprised if there were some changes to it, but I think that the essential meat and potatoes of what the agreement is will definitely come back. I mean, this is about undermining Iran's capabilities of exerting any kind of self-defense or influence throughout the region. And this was very much put forward with the new ballistic missiles that were used on dummy targets, which it demonstrated an 1,800-kilometer range. So with that new demonstration of power, I would certainly think that the Biden administration will probably come up with some kind of pretext to attack Iran on those grounds, or probably make some kind of demand to undermine that capability.
Now back to Mr. Tim Anderson. Mr. Onrua believes that the Biden administration will try to rejoin the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. But do you believe that the Israeli lobby would allow this to happen? We do understand that the Trump administration did so under the influence of Israelis.
Yes, I think Biden will make some initiatives, because remember, not all of the coercive measures that the U.S. has imposed are linked to the JCPOA. They're beyond that. And in the U.S., the discussion in the last 5 years has been trying to extend it, particularly into missile technology. Now, at the moment, it's not included at all. And, of course, that is now the immediate threat that perhaps Israel and also some of the other U.S. allies in the Gulf and the U.S. Shipping itself fears from Iran, the missile capability. There's no incentive for Iran to extend the JCPOA into missile technology. So, but I think there will be some a pretense of shifting. That is to say, I think the Biden administration will shift and drop some of those, what did Trump call it, the maximum pressure sanctions, to try and show some sort of goodwill there. But it will be difficult for the Biden administration, I believe, not just because of the Republican opposition, but because of a number within the Democrats also, who are now buying into this argument that they will lose their leverage if they simply go back and adopt the 2015 agreement as is. Because it had sunset clauses which have expired or going to expire, it doesn't include the missile controls that they wanted, and some of the Europeans have bought into that too. So there's going to be a very big debate in the U.S. about this, and while they may drop some sanctions, I think there's going to be a lot of internal wrangling about simply going back and adopting the agreement as it was 5 years ago or 6 years ago.
Thank you very much, Mr. Onrua. The final question is for you, and considering the rift that we see in the U.S. Society, there's a big gap between the two sides. Do you believe that Joe Biden would actually risk going back to the 2015 nuclear deal without any preconditions, considering the situation he is facing domestically?
I don't think so. I don't think that he's willing to risk it at this time. As we do recall, the Trump administration, on its way out the door, decided to accuse Iran of being affiliated with Al-Qaeda, which is essentially a nonsense claim. So I can see what they're setting up here, so that when Biden comes in and tries to return to the JCPOA, the Republican Party can then turn around and claim that Biden is being soft on Al-Qaeda because they're not allegedly being hard enough on Iran. So I think that there's a dimension there that will incentivize the Democratic Party to be harder on Iran than would be than they would prefer to be. But I think in the end, it's still, with that accusation, whether it's there or not, is still going to serve imperialist interests.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies out of Sydney, and Mr. Jason Andrua, political commentator out of Ontario. Now, Iran and the Republic of Azerbaijan have hailed the expansion of bilateral ties between the two neighbors. This comes during an official visit by Azerbaijan's Deputy Prime Minister Shahin Mustafayev to Tehran.
Both sides are satisfied with the results of the Iran-Azerbaijan Joint Commission. Both sides work together to create a vast cooperation in these new circumstances. The relationship between our countries has been extended in the past 7 years. We have had hundreds of meetings together and signed more than 40 agreements, strengthening our ties as neighboring countries.
Now, the U.S. military has reportedly carried out airstrikes on Iraqi forces in the town of Jurfal Shakra in Babil province. Iraqi media have reported several explosions in the town, saying the targeted area belonged to the Iraqi army. 3 U.S. drones and a warplane were reportedly involved in the raid that left at least 6 people dead and several others wounded. There have been no immediate comments either from the Iraqi government or the U.S. military stationed in the Arab country. Moving on, Tunisian police have clashed with demonstrators as nationwide protests against police and an economic crisis have entered the third night. Security forces used tear gas and water cannons to quell the protesters who were throwing stones, gasoline bombs, and burning tires in the capital, Tunis. The demonstrations began on Friday after a video went viral showing an officer pushing a shepherd whose sheep entered the government building. Police say they have arrested over 1,000 people involved in the rioting. Protests also followed the 10th anniversary of a popular uprising that pushed former President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali from power. 10 years on, anger is growing at chronic joblessness and poor state services in the country. Meanwhile, President Kais Saied has asked people to stop violent protests, warning that some political forces are trying to sow chaos. Guatemalan security forces have cleared a road blocked by hundreds of migrants, mostly from Honduras, on their way to the United States. Police forces armed with batons and shields dispersed the migrants who had camped out on an overnight road in eastern Guatemala. Minor clashes were also reported there. The caravan with 8,000 migrants departed from Honduras on Friday, but has been held up near the Guatemalan border. The Guatemalan government says it cannot allow them to pass without travel documents or a negative coronavirus test. Honduran migrants flee poverty and violence in the country, hammered by the coronavirus pandemic and back-to-back hurricanes. Now, political commentator Life Malcolm says the United States is responsible for the poverty and corruption in Central America.
The United States could be held responsible and very well should be held responsible. The United States have had its hands in the corruption, the poverty, the chaos, the turmoil, and all of the other disasters you can imagine socially in the Central American part of the world. The United States, as you know, instituted and facilitated a coup of the democratically elected president in 1954, Jacobo Arbenz, in Guatemala. And since that time, the United States has forced Guatemala to be its watchdog, so to speak. And so when you have people like those families in the Honduras scrambling for resources and looking to the United States as the place where they can get a piece of bread and maybe a coin or two, you have to trace that history back to the United States machinations in Guatemala and other Central American areas.
As U.S. President Donald Trump prepares to leave office after weeks of whipping supporters into violent frenzy, his approval ratings have hit the lowest. According to a Gallup poll, just 34% of public in the U.S. approve of Trump's performance in the winning days. In the final days of his presidency, his role in inciting a violent mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol and his impeachment have hit his approval ratings. Trump is the only U.S. president not to register a 50% job approval rating at any point in his presidency. With President-elect Joe Biden set to take over on January 20th, around 25,000 National Guard troops have been deployed on D.C. streets. In his last few days in office, Trump is expected to issue around 100 pardons and commutations, which include white-collar criminals and his controversial allies. Now, in France, the average daily coronavirus infections have hit over a six-week high with more than 18,000 confirmed cases. Unlike Britain or Germany, the French government has stopped short of imposing a third national lockdown. However, a nationwide curfew remains in place to curb the surge in cases. France has so far reported over 70,000 deaths out of more than 2.9 million cases. Meanwhile, the UK has closed its travel corridors until February 15th to curb the spread of a new variant of COVID-19. The Europeans keep struggling with the second wave of the pandemic. In Germany, the health minister says while the infection numbers seem to be decreasing, the country is still not stable.
In the infection numbers, we seem to be going down where we look at the last few days, as well as the situation in the intensive care units, where there are 10 to 15% fewer COVID-19 patients now than at the peak. That seems to be moving in the right direction, but we are still a long way from where we need to be.
German authorities have registered over 7,000 new cases, taking the total infections to over 2 million. The virus has also so far claimed more than 47,000 lives in the country. Elsewhere in Europe, Italy registered nearly 9,000 new cases and 377 more deaths. The country has logged over 82,000 deaths so far, the second highest in Europe. Portugal's daily death toll from the virus also reached a record high of 167 on Monday, bringing the total to over 9,000. The country has been under lockdown since last week, with hospitals struggling to cope with soaring contagion. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. This is the old theme song of the kids' program. When I was a child, I used to sit before TV every day, so impatiently to watch the kids' program. Oh, well, childhood memories never disappear. Sometimes a sound, a scent, or even an old photo take you to the memorable past. Today I'm going to take you to a very memorable place, to Iranak Museum of Childhood in Tehran. Iranak Museum of Childhood is the outcome of almost 20 years of research on the history of children's literature. This museum is located at the National Library and Archives of Iran. In addition to being appropriate for all children's age groups, Iranak Museum of Childhood takes adults to their childhood memories as well. This museum recounts the importance of childhood history and culture from thousands of years ago until today. This place is not founded for the purpose of visiting old tools. Rather, this collection is aimed at providing an atmosphere for people for being a child or even going back to childhood, by presenting narrations, stories, plays, or games, so that people are more interactive and engage in new common experiences. Introducing the prominent figures who have worked in the area of children is one of the other purposes of founding this museum. I am now at the Iranak Museum of Childhood. Just in front of me, there is a showcase which its content is amazing. Ah, the replica of children's board of exercise for 4,000 years ago. Can you believe it? The original version of these boards are being kept in National Museum of Iran. On these boards, there are sentences written with cuneiform characters, which reads wise man and also little wise man. This part of the Iranak Museum of Childhood displays the toys which used to entertain Iranian kids since very old times. This is sutsutak, a kind of whistle which is made of clay. And these are the statues of animals which children used to play with them. Oh, look at these rattles. Very cute. I wish I could hear their sound. In this museum, pieces of music or songs suitable for children are played. Can you hear? It takes me to my childhood. Oh, look at here. There are children's magazines. These magazines are fantastic. And here, there are newer magazines which we are allowed to touch and turn over the pages. These magazines are very memorable. And in this part of the Iranak Museum of Childhood, there are tools which were used for taking care of infants and babies at those times. Things like a cradle, wooden saddle, which is a traditional kind of cradle, feeding utensils, and hygienic stuff, which are really old. And in this part, there are discovered graves of children with the age of 3,000 years. Ah, life and death are twin brothers.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You are listening to, and with me in the studio are two experts, two Islamic scholars from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Ali Alavian and Said Mohsen Naghvi. This series of Viewpoints is concerned with the speeches and thoughts of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Before anything, let's say salam to the experts over here. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, and brother Alavian, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thanks for having me here.
You're welcome, brother. You know that 1 year have passed the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani, who was killed in a drone attack by the U.S., last year, and for the commemoration ceremony of this dear general of Iran, Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, tried to dedicate this series of the program to the speeches and thoughts of Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about General Soleimani. Brother Ali, this istikbar, you know, and it's breakdown in the region by Qasem Soleimani and ISIS, which really they spend lots of money in the region. But a man like Soleimani with some, we can say, barricades from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran, Fatemiyun, Zainabiyun, okay, comes to the scene and stop all these, we can say, money expenditure over there in the region. ISIS, you know, we know they were rich. Their military, we can say, facilities were really high and modern. So what's your take on that, brother?
Yeah, on the continuation of actually enumerating the features of the school of thought of Soleimani, I think we shall get to that point as well. We wanted to mention some other features that the fourth that we want to focus on today is his purity of intention that was actually pinpointed in our previous session, and not being a person of pretension and hypocrisy. It is quite clear for Iranians, those who have sensed him in the country, that even after his martyrdom, people understood what a great person he was. You know, he did not let those cameramen to broadcast whatever have been recorded from it.
That's right.
So these scenes of, let's say, purity of this person to be in different battlefields, not only in the battlefield of war, I don't know, against ISIS, but even at the time that, for example, he was needed in the flood of Khuzestan province.
Yeah, the natural disasters.
Natural disasters in different parts. In the north of Iran, again, we had some flood issues.
Yeah.
So he was present there.
He was a social activist over there, that's
very
right.
True. Okay. So we see that this sort of activities seen from a general, high-ranking general, cannot be seen in different countries and, let's say, different nations.
This
I don't know.
This is very much different from the generals who are very, we can say, sharp and serious. You know, the generals, usually the military ones, are shown with the medals over the chest. Soleimani was not over there. Okay.
And the next feature of the school of thought of Soleimani was the spirituality, I can call it. Mm-hmm. What does this spirituality mean? Mm-hmm. Usually, colonels, generals, even if they are Muslims, and specifically, let's say, the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt, in the battlefield, based on some jurisprudential ahkam or, let's say, decrees, based on some fiqh issues, in some special cases, they are free from doing, for example, some of their obligatory acts.
That's
in
right.
Very special cases.
Yes.
But this person actually tuned himself to even to adhere all those obligatory and even recommended actions that was on him to be done in its right time. And
yes.
Parallel to that, he does his job actually exactly as it was required.
Right.
So this person was a man of tahajjud and salatul layl, the night prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, even in, I want to compare to others. Let's say, how many do we have, for example, from armed forces to be, for example, in that, let's say, state of, let's say, spirituality and obedience towards God, which was expected to be seen from, for example, as a religious scholar.
Mm-hmm.
So this person, in the, let's say, poems that he was reciting.
Being a religious man inside a mosque is very easy.
Yeah,
but being a religious man inside a field of military action is really difficult.
Very
you know,
true.
And when you are safe, okay, being religious is really easy.
Yeah,
especially when you see your like men being killed by the enemies, and you capture someone.
Yeah,
you need to obviously at that time, everyone is angry. Especially we have seen like in different wars, they do oppress those people, and Islam stops. Like from oppressing anyone, even the captives. Mm-hmm. And Qasem Soleimani has these characteristics that he never oppressed anyone. He never went beyond beyond the limits.
Yeah.
He was within his limits. And that's what obviously we need to learn from him. That how to be, you know, for example, we see like some people, unfortunately, when they go home, the husbands, when they're very much angry, they beat their, for example, wives. Wow. We have this oppression, like these things, like why this thing is happening with the women. It's because the people are going beyond their limits.
That's right.
And he, in the battlefield, he remained in his...
Of course, we do not recommend beating the women inside the house, okay? This is not
it's
at all...
It's just an example, yeah.
Yeah, okay. But the case is that... One more case I want to
mention, because it is related to our discussion that even Sayed actually explained it. When he was sieged in Syria once, and he was obliged to stay, for example, in a house that was, and the people of the house were not there, he wrote a letter to the owner of the house that I prayed in your house, I think, two times
without your
permission, but it was it was out of my will, let's say. Right. And he asked him, in case you are happy with it, please accept my apologies. In case you do not agree, please, this is my phone number. Please call me so that I compensate for the time that I have been here in your house,
and I perform
my prayers.
In another footage, he is talking about halal and haram.
Yeah.
You know, talking about halal and haram, especially in a war operation, is very difficult. We know that in all the operations that were led by Qasem Soleimani, no innocent, ordinary men or women or children were killed. None of them. By the Iranian forces, okay? But on the vice versa, I mean, by Daesh and the ISIS, so many people were killed. He says that the lives of the people that you are operating in this operation are like the amana in your hands.
Very true.
So this amana or trust, as long as it is your hand, you have to take care of that.
And this line, again, remember the brothers and sisters who are listening, was taken from the teachings of Imam Khomeini while in the imposed eight-year war. Imam Khomeini, when we were under the missiles, Iraqi missiles, like the a city like Dasful, who received more than 1,600 missiles during the wartime. But Imam did not allow any of these army people to reply them back. He said, because... They don't care if they kill ordinary people, but we don't want to kill ordinary people in the war. So the root of this, let's say, tactic is taken from, as you rightly mentioned in previous show, the leader, and the leader from the Imam.
Yeah, Rahim. The love of humans.
American drones, like, they kill many innocent people in Yemen, in Iraq, in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
They've killed many of the innocent people, and they don't care about these things. So this is what we need to... Obviously, there must be some criteria for the general people.
Yeah.
The people who are listening, they need to make some criteria to choose between right and wrong. Sure. And obviously, the school of Qasem Soleimani has unveiled the reality of the Americans who so-called... who call themselves as to be the... You know, the ones who have raised the human rights flag. Right. So this is also one of the threats.
Another beautiful thing which was said by... I do want to say that even in the opponent groups of the Islamic Republic of Iran outside, Qasem Soleimani was welcomed as a face who fought for an international integrity. This is very important. Because whenever they are criticizing Islamic Revolution of Iran or the policies inside, they say, okay, they are Muslims, they want to act as Islamic as possible and do not regard Iran. But Qasem Soleimani has shown that Iran and Islam both are important for him. This is very important, the weight that he gives to the Iranian people, regardless of their language, of their color, of their race inside Iran. He was really... we can say the embodiment of Iran and the Iranian cultural values.
It's true that in case he was not in the battlefront, for example, in neighboring countries or in Lebanon or in Yemen or anywhere else in the world, the enemies were among us in the, let's say, western borders of our country. But it does not necessarily mean that he was helping them just to save Iran. No. I think in Islam, we don't have a geographical border. Even in his behavior, in pathological look in his behavior, it looks that he looked an Iranian exactly with the same eye that he was looking at Iraqi or Yemen.
Yeah, thank you much, Brother Ali Alevian and Thayed Mohsen Naqvi for presence in the program. Viewpoints, it was very kind of you, dear listeners. Thank you much for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Do not forget to visit our website, parstudio.com/Ian Khalil Islam page, also YouTube page, Khalil of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
اصطفاك واجتباك للخلود في تراك للقاك هل أعود أو وراك في سماك من جديد ذات يوم فيه قبري عند قبرك ويشم الناس روحانا بعطرك إن روحي الآن كم تشتاق وصلك قد تأخرت كثيرا توت بعدك من دماك لعلاك يا شهيد اصطفاك واجتباك للخلود في ثراك للقاك هل أعود أو وراك في سماك من جديد يبقى باب أشلاء يزار أو بقايا من وصاياي الكثار بالشهادات أنت حققت انتصار وانتظرت أنا لألحق بالمسار من دماك لعلاك يا شهيد اصطفاك واجتباك للخلود في ثراك للقاك هل أعود وراك في سماك من جديد
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
the limelight.
The pandemic is a global reminder of what many have never been allowed to forget. The stifling inequality engendered by capitalism takes lives, sometimes quickly and often slowly. With encampment evictions, the state punishes those being suffocated for gasping to breathe, says Aziza Kenji, writer, in an article published under the heading Homeless Encampment Evictions Highlight the Cruelty of Capitalism Amid COVID. Here's the details. In Canada's homeless encampments, two faces of state brutality are on display. One is the organized abandonment that has relegated hundreds of thousands across Canada to homelessness at twice the rate as in the United States. The other is the organized violence that evicts homeless people from encampments erected in the shadow of the state's malign neglect. In Toronto, Canada's largest and most unequal city, frontline workers estimate there are currently 1,000 to 2,000 people sleeping in dozens of encampments outdoors, several times more than the 400 acknowledged by city officials. Against the advice of the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention and the former UN Special Rapporteur on Housing, the municipality has been raising encampments in the name of safety and health, relocating people to institutional spaces that are far from healthy or safe. Nobody cares about us, said Moose Park encampment resident Casey. It's like we are a bed bug in their building that they just want to exterminate. Even before the pandemic, Toronto's dangerously overcrowded shelter system was a petri dish for disease transmission, to quote the longtime street nurse Katie Crow. A study published recently in the Canadian Medical Association Journal found COVID infection rates of 41.7% in one large Toronto shelter. Mobile testing in the encampments, in contrast, has detected zero cases among residents so far, according to Indigenous frontline health worker Les Harper. In the city's shelter hotels, hotels in nothing but name, people report being uprooted from their support networks, required to room with strangers, and surprised with intrusive wellness checks while in the shower, naked or asleep at night, according to frontline workers. Since they are permitted to bring only two bags of possessions, many leave poorer than when they arrived. Meanwhile, in temporary respites like the so-called Better Living Center, physical distancing is achieved by caging people in transparent glass boxes while the lights have been left on for 24 hours a day. In other contexts, such conditions have been characterized not as better living but torture. The imposition of such solutions to homelessness without consulting homeless people themselves exemplifies the state's violent benevolence, in which instrumental violence is narrated as gentle or non-violent, even when it's violent and is experienced as oppressive, in the words of anti-poverty scholar activist A.J. Withers and critical social work academic Chris Chapman. Even in the frigid temperatures, many houseless people are deciding to sleep outside instead, or are forced to by persistent shelter unavailability. Contrary to the city's claims of increased capacity during the pandemic, there are 1,158 fewer shelter spaces available this winter in Toronto as compared to last. 61% of requests received by the city for shelter are turned away. Many of the people sleeping in the encampments know people who have died outside in the winter. Social worker Kristen Howard attested to Toronto City Council. In apparent dissociation from this reality, City Press releases applaud the extraordinary steps taken to help and protect people experiencing homelessness during COVID-19. The government presents a menu of bad options, then expects gratitude for the crumbs dispensed. As its press releases proclaim, Toronto consistently places at the top of international rankings due to the investments championed by its government, residents and businesses. Left unmentioned is that these international rankings include being one of the most unaffordable cities in the world, having one of the largest super-rich wealth gaps in the world, and being the child poverty capital of a country that has one of the highest child poverty rates in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Toronto spends almost five times more on policing than on shelter and housing. At the current legislated minimum wage, a worker would work 14 hours a day, 7 days a week to affordably rent an apartment in the city. The waiting list for social housing is 7 to 10 years long. All levels of Canadian government have stripped funding for vital social goods like housing to the bone, while fattening the institutions of violent social control such as military and police. Even money ostensibly allocated for social welfare has in some cases turned out to be yet more police enrichment by another route. For example, 99% of the Ontario government $200 million grant for community safety and well-being ended up back in police coffers. In the disaster opportunism of the pandemic, the provincial government has further extended its emergency powers for up to 2 years, while measures protecting renters from eviction have been ripped away. In fact, evictions have been further facilitated with the new, perversely named, Protecting Tenants and Strengthening Community Housing Act, known as the Eviction Act, by those on the receiving end of its protection. While corporate landlords have continued to reap large profit margins, impoverished tenants have been forced to beg for their homes in mass online eviction hearings, 7,000 in November alone. These eviction hearings are a pipeline to encampments, observes lawyer Dania Majid of Advocacy Center for Tenants Ontario. In Toronto, 600 new people have been entering the shelter system every month, according to the city's own data, which has a pattern of understanding the numbers to make the problem disappear, if only on paper. Having jettisoned the possibility of ensuring genuinely affordable housing and a livable wage, the state directs its resources towards penalizing the survival strategies of the dispossessed. The Ontario Superior Court has refused to suspend Toronto by laws prohibiting people from sleeping in parks, maintaining that parks are public resources intended to be available and used by everyone, except, apparently, by homeless people for activities necessary for life. As Brendan Jowett, one of the lawyers who brought the case, argues, what was really at stake was not whether people can use public parks for recreation, but whether people can use public parks without being reminded of the city's social ills. Even efforts to mitigate the state's public cruelty with private generosity have been disciplined. Carpenter Khalil Suedride was threatened by the city with legal action for constructing tiny shelters for people sleeping outside. With the expansion of pandemic policing powers, the burden of intensified harassment has been borne primarily by homeless people. indigenous people and black people, the same shoulders on which the greatest share of police brutality has been inflicted. In recent years, Toronto cops have been caught targeting homeless people with hefty fines for fabricated offenses in order to increase their numbers after forfeiting a few days' pay. These officers have been permitted back out onto the beat, making $100,000 per year. The state traps homeless people in an impossible position. They are deprived of housing, but prohibited from sleeping in public space. They are denied public washroom and shower facilities, but punished for performing necessary bodily function outdoors. A fundamental feature of the rule of law is that the law must be possible to obey. Instead of the rule of law, homeless people are subjected to the law of rule, crushed under the force of law's punishment, but excluded from its protection. Housing is a human right under international law, yet in Canadian, as in the United States courts, this basic floor of human entitlement is treated as an unattainable ceiling. Canadian judges refuse to recognize housing as part of the constitutional right to life, liberty, and security of the person, or to include homelessness as a prohibited ground of discrimination because it is not an immutable characteristic. Strangely, the fact that governments could change the situation is used to let them off the hook for actually changing the situation. Other rights, such as protection against unreasonable search and seizure, have in fact been treated as void for people lacking control over private property. In encampment evictions, city employees have slashed tents open with knives, reportedly sometimes while those dwelling in them are still inside, according to frontline worker Greg Cook, and confiscated and destroyed people's belongings, including medication. Most, if not all, of the rights and freedoms set out in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms presuppose a person who has moved beyond the basic struggle for existence, as legal academic Martha Jackman points out. The Charter records rights which can only be fully enjoyed by people who are fed, are clothed, are sheltered, have access to necessary health care, to education, and to a minimum level of income. This illustrates the paradox of human rights identified by philosopher Hannah Arendt. The human stripped of everything but their humanity effectively has no human rights. Arendt was referring specifically to the condition of statelessness. The fact that being without property resembles being without a state is a sign of how deeply citizenship has been capitalized and commodified. In this neoliberal paradigm, Toronto refers to its shelter request response system as an exercise in customer service. Never mind that many of the customers are repeatedly told there is no room at the inn.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.